Support for the show comes from Schwab. With Schwab Investing Themes, you can invest in what's trending in artificial intelligence, big data, robotic revolution, and more. It's an easy way to invest in ideas you believe in. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes, buy all the stocks in a theme as is, or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.
Support for Pivot comes from ServiceNow. By now, you've probably heard about AI. You might even be sick of hearing about it. But despite all the hype, it's not always clear how AI can help your business. ServiceNow has some ideas. With their intelligent platform, they can put AI to work across your company, improving customer experiences, helping non-coders code, accelerating your IT team's productivity, and resolving HR cases faster. So, work can actually work better for everyone. So stop the hype and start putting AI to work. Go to servicenow.com/genAI to see why the world works with ServiceNow.
Hi, everyone. This is Pivot from New York Magazine and the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Kara Swisher.
And I'm Scott Galloway.
Hello, Scott. How you doing?
Good, Kara. Back in London?
Oh, I'm finally back in D.C. for a very short period of time.
Oh, good. And where are you headed next?
Boston to do one with the governor, and Princeton, New Jersey to do one at my old high school, and also at Princeton University. And then I'm going to see Louis in Buenos Aires.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You're going to be right.
I'm so excited.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you like me on Bill Maher?
I'm serious, Kara. I thought you were outstanding. I thought that was one of your better. I thought you just nailed it. And I sent you a text message that you should take pause and reflect on the moment.
Sweet.
I thought you were really, really smart. And not only that, I thought he was great. I thought the way he interviewed you, the banter was good. He made a couple really, I thought, really interesting points.
Yeah. Yeah. But more to the point, do you like my new best friend, Justin Thoreau, who also knows you?
Just FYI. Yeah. I was friends with Justin first.
Not anymore.
Just so you know.
I gave him the Bill Maher vest.
Just so you know.
I gave him the soft, lovely vest. He looks really
you're
good.
You're like the girl in high school that when I like a guy, you start fucking him. I mean, Justin pinged me.
To be clear, I am not fucking him, but go ahead.
Well, you know what I mean. Anyways, Justin Thoreau reached out to me and said, let's get together and da da da. We're both. And then all of a sudden, you're taking him to Bill Maher.
We had lunch before at the Chateau Marmont.
He's very substantive. He's very soulful.
He is. He's a writer. He's really interesting.
Yeah, very good. He has a pit bull, too.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. We don't know each other that well yet. So we will in time, of course.
You're not good friends like me and Justin. I'll dial you
we'll
on.
We'll go out. We'll all
his
go
fetishes,
out.
His fetishes, you know.
We'll all go out. He's a lovely guy.
By the way, also, just in case you didn't know, he's circumcised.
Okay. Good to know. I didn't know. And anyway, thank you about Bill Maher. It was fun, actually. It was really well
great.
Done. He did great.
You were really good.
It was very helpful. And of course, the freaking out because of the Elons. I got attacked by Elon over the weekend. And then also I was on Jen Psaki's show and she was noting that he's for Trump, but pretending he's not. And then they, you know, I said, hello, he lied. And they saying I said he was a liar. I just was making a joke. In any case,
well, let me just clarify. He is a liar.
He's
the lying fuck of lying liars.
And there you have it.
Either that, or he's so high on some disassociative drug he can't disassociate with the truth any longer.
Yeah, that could be possible too. All right. Anything else?
Go ahead. I thought you were great on Bill Maher.
Justin Thoreau has great hair. Anyway, we have a lot to get to today. Including what's in the DOJ antitrust case against Apple and how Truth Social is factoring into Donald Trump's money issues. Plus, our friend of Pivot is Jim Sciutto, CNN's national security analyst. There's a lot going on, including what's just happened in Russia. And he's the author of The Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War. It's a good week to have him on, given this attack in Russia and, of course, everything that continues to happen in Ukraine and Israel and Gaza. But first, employees at NBC News and MSNBC are not happy after the announcement that former RNC chair Ron McDaniel would be hired as a political analyst. The move has been met with disappointment internally, I would say more than that, including Chuck Todd, who said McDaniel has credibility issues. Chuck went to town on Meet the Press. Kristen Welker had to interview McDaniel, who had been booked before she was hired. So she continued with it and gave her a pretty tough interview. But Chuck Todd sort of unloaded in a relatively polite style, but pretty tough about what people inside NBC feel. She's an election denier, and then she suddenly isn't. She's obviously going back on everything she said because it's just her talking now, not as the head of the RNC. In an effort to address the backlash, MSNBC's president, Rashida Jones, told anchors they would not be forced to have McDaniel on their shows. I mean, just the stink of her is a problem, though. So what do you think?
Okay, I'll go, but I feel as if you have more domain expertise here.
No, I want to hear what you have to say first. I'm really curious because you're a regular Joe, so to speak.
Regular Joe. I'm just a Joe. It strikes me that in this era, being a spokesperson for the DNC or the RNC or being, there are quite a few spokespeople from the Trump White House who have recovered and gone on to get decent jobs. And they acknowledge that what they said a lot of times, you know, it's like Republicans seem to grow testicles about the time they're out the door, right? Bill Barr can't stop talking about what a bad president he was serving. And I mean, so the question I would have if I were in the MSNBC war room trying to deal with this is how much of this is the duplicitous, hypocritical, disingenuous previous behavior of someone? And do we apply the same standards to people who come from Democratic organizations who have taken license with the truth? So it's a tough one because generally speaking in media, they kind of give you a little bit of a hall pass when you're in a political position before that.
I agree with you. They're all over the place. Look, George Stephanopoulos worked for Clinton. He's now quite a good host of the Sunday show. Same thing with Jen Psaki. Excellent. I was on her show. She's quite good. She does disclose it. And she's not, the issue is she's not at cross purposes to what she said then, right? This was an astonishing interview with Kristen Welker. Like this woman is a full-scale election denier, not just a little bit, not like questions, we need to ask questions. She was an election denier, and now she isn't. So which one of, I mean, so she's a liar at one point, whichever one. And even now, why did she change her mind? I'd like a long explanation from her as to why she did.
Because she's no longer being paid to lie. And that's the same as other people.
That's right. But I'd like her to say it out of her meat flaps. That's what I'd like. There's certain people, I get it, they come in. You know, whether you've got, I'm trying to think. I mean, they do it over on Fox. They do it on all of them. They bring in these generals, et cetera, et cetera. I think holding their feet to the fire when you're talking to them, this woman seems, you know, there was a controversy at CNN over Sarah Isker, who was actually on Mar this week. I think there's a smell test with some people more than others. And I think you're not going to prevent this from happening because, you know, their experts are often people who worked, you know, like David Axelrod but you don't have an issue with David Axelrod because he says what he thinks and it's just that this woman went really far. Like picking this lady is, I don't know. It's sort of like if you took in, if you made Pence one, it would be a problem for me. I don't know. Just there's a couple people where they just don't get to come back in that regard. And, you know, they'll say they're not allowed to speak, but they should go on Fox News if they want to do that. She could do that. They have no standards over there. So I think this is a real black eye to NBC, like a real black eye. And I'm surprised that they did it with her because she's so egregious. She's like beyond egregious. So we'll see. I think it's going to have a backlash forever. And I think the right will say, oh, you know, they're trying to cancel her. But she deserves to be canceled in that regard, especially because she said things with Trump and now she's trying to backtrack because this is me. And I'm just like, you have no credibility. What's credibility issues? She has none. So anyway, we'll move on. Speaking of credibility issues, Boeing's chief executive, David Calhoun, will step down at the end of the year following several plane safety failures. In addition, the company's CEO of Boeing Commercial Airplanes will resign immediately, and its chairman, Larry Kellner, will not seek leave. It's a clean out. See, other people pay the price, Scott. This is interesting. The announcement comes less than 3 months after the door plug blew off a Boeing MAX 9 during the Alaska Airlines flight. The FAA audit of production found dozens of issues and gave the company 90 days for fixes. I mean, it looks so sloppy. Will this help the Boeing brand bounce back or do they take too long? I think they move quickly because, you know, look, as you say, there's never been a perp walk for tech. You know, there's never been someone like arrested for a girl's self-esteem, but one door blows off and everyone goes to jail, essentially, or gets fired or investigated or lawsuits, et cetera. What do you think?
So first off, you could argue it's a bit unfair because he's been the CEO since 2019, and there's very little he could do
when there's literally thousands of these very complicated machines in the air, there's little he could institute in, you know, 4 years that would turn this thing around.
I guess.
Having said that, this was absolutely the right thing to do. Because here's the thing. We always make excuses for CEOs when they make 300 or 400 times the average worker that's okay. It's the market. They benefit. He got a bit of a raw deal. But the bottom line is when your planes start having malfunctions midair, head's got to roll. Is it a little bit unfair? Was he the wrong place at the wrong time? Yeah. But guess what? The majority of CEOs in Fortune 500 companies tend to be constantly in the right place at the right time. And there's only three things you have to remember about crisis management, and then I'll get to a broader viewpoint on aviation. And that is, in crisis management, you just got to remember three things. And everyone always gets it wrong because they sound easy, but they're not. The first is you have to acknowledge the problem. You know, this is unacceptable. This is what happened. Two, the top guy or gal has to take responsibility. They need to be out in front. And then third, you need to overcorrect. And this is what the board is doing. The board is saying, look, it's probably not fair. They could probably make all sorts of excuses for why he's actually trying to address these problems and turn around a tanker of a culture that resulted in these things. But they're like, you know what? We have to overcorrect. We're sorry, but we have to show we're really serious about this. And then the larger point around aviation is people don't appreciate global aviation, which is really only several decades old. The majority, people really didn't start using the lubricant of global commerce in terms of face-to-face meetings and diplomacy via commercial jet transportation literally until the 60s or 70s. It's a fairly new thing. It is also fucking frightening and unbelievable that you can skirt along the surface of the atmosphere at 8/10 the speed of sound and get to your destination safely. It is literally a wondrous feat, and it is so important to the global economy that the FAA decided, we're going to make this so ridiculously safe. We're going to impose a set of standards that are so over-engineered. Imagine your car, a mechanic showed up, and this isn't an exaggeration, every third day and said, I'm going to change the spark plugs, the tires, I'm going to test everything, I'm going to deploy and redeploy the airbags. I'm just going to make sure this thing is absolutely bulletproof. That is what they do in the FAA. And the success of that approach is that people have absolutely no issue saying, I have to go pick up my kids at camp. I'm going to get on a plane. I have an opportunity to sell software into a company in Toronto. The most neurotic. You don't even have to be that neurotic to get on a plane and be scared.
Oh, my brother doesn't fly. My little brother doesn't fly.
But that's unusual. The majority of people,
it's a pain in the ass too.
The majority of people take the risk and get on planes because it is by far the safest form of transportation in the world, and it's lubricated the global economy. So their attention, neurotic, obsessive, compulsive, anal retentive focus on safety has paid huge dividends globally.
Listen, he didn't deserve, may not have deserved it, doesn't really matter. He took the big job. The buck stopped there. The buck always stops there. And it should happen in tech more often. Okay, last one. The Kate Middleton mystery has been solved, and it has us remembering that the internet is bad. By now, we know she has cancer, is going through preventative chemotherapy for weeks. Conspiracy theories and jokes have been floating around online about Middleton's whereabouts, even reaching the late night shows. There was a big piece that we should all feel bad. I don't know about that. I think it's a combination of really bad PR on the point of them. I mean, if she's a global figure, as much as she might expect some privacy, they made it worse. And at the same time, you know, now you look like idiots for making fun of a cancer victim. So it's sort of the internet is this way. And I don't really know if we have to like blame the internet at this point, because it does it on every story. And I don't know. What do you think?
I think you can hold two thoughts in your mind at the same time. The first thought is a 42-year-old woman who is battling cancer, who has three children. It's very sad. You want to feel empathy for her. You want her. The last thing you'd want to do is have anything add to that pain. I mean, you can absolutely have empathy for her and respect it and understand why she may have made the decisions she made. At the same time, with all due respect, when you pick a life that includes wearing the crown's jewels and going to every cool event and being called the Duchess of whatever, there's incredible downsides. And one of those downsides is if you get sick, the public's going to find out, or they're going to go fucking apeshit trying to figure it out. So bottom line, whoever's handling comms for the palace fucked up here. Because they should have said, we're very sorry, Kate. This is awful. We feel for you. This is going to come out. And until we're straight with the public about what's going on here, it is going to be a shit show. And it's going to make things worse. So this, I'm not talking about what should be. I'm talking about what is.
Right. Agreed. I don't even think what should be. They're the most famous family in Britain, and they're going to look at, they get covered on everything. Let me just tell you, her video was classy. It was lovely. It was appropriate. I don't think she needed to say anything else about her cancer. Everyone's That's now fine. Wondering about
I'm
that.
Sick.
I'm sick. I have cancer, and I'm not going to tell you what it is, but I'm going to tell you I'm trying to deal with my family. It was a combination of bad things. We wish her well. And she's young and healthy. And so from what I understand should be, hopefully, this will be one of those, like my own stroke. It'll be your footnote, hopefully.
You're right. Kate is young. We've made remarkable progress against cancer. More people actually survive cancer now than die from it.
Yeah. Four of my friends, they're doing good. I have four friends who have cancer young.
But the analogy I thought of with Kate, and I realize it's a different situation, but if Biden is out of public eyeshot for 24 hours, everyone's going to start freaking out. I mean, you want to talk, everyone will start turning into, Sherlock Holmes.
Wouldn't it be nice if Trump was out of eyeshot for 24 hours? But he won't be. He's always sort of eating breakfast at Mar-a-Lago. Anyway, we feel badly for her and King Charles. Let's get to our first big story. We're learning more about the Justice Department's lawsuit against Apple, which accuses the company of maintaining a monopoly over the smartphone market. The suit, which the DOJ filed with 16 states, argues Apple violated antitrust laws by making it difficult for competitors to integrate with the iPhone, ultimately driving up prices for consumers. The DOJ cites the App Store, smartwatches, cloud-based gaming and messaging apps, that green dot, as some examples of Apple's monopoly. Interestingly, Mr. Walt Mossberg made a case that this is a ridiculous thing. Apple said in a statement that the lawsuit is wrong on the facts and the law, and the company will vigorously defend against it. The side that Walt was on is that it's not unusual. He said on Threads, that's like calling the best-selling expensive wine a monopoly when it actually has a modest overall market share. He is correct about that. The iPhone U.S. market share is 62% in Q4 of 2023 in terms of shipments, according to Counterpoint Research. The DOJ argues that Apple has more than 70% market share in the U.S. measuring by revenue, and other metrics show Apple's dominance, particularly in terms of young users. Let me just get through this, and I'd just love your thoughts. A comment made by Tim Cook at Code 2022 is also mentioned in the DOJ suit. Cook was responding to an audience question about improving communication with non-Apple devices. Let's listen to what he said exactly, since we've been mentioning it.
I don't hear our users asking that we put a lot of energy in on that at this point. And so now I would love to
continue.
I would love to convert you to iPhone.
Okay.
It's tough. Not to make it personal, but I can't send my mom certain videos, or she can't send me certain videos. And so we leave.
Buy your mom an iPhone.
The DOJ is making the case that Apple's messaging interface with those green text bubbles for non-iPhone users created a social stigma. So let's go through it.
First off, if you're a guy and you send an attempt for a late night hookup or a booty call and it comes from an Android bubble, I think the likelihood you end up having sex that night is literally diminished dramatically.
Oh, as usual, you go right to the heart of it. Go ahead.
Well, look. This is all about, look, Apple's all about sex. It's a subtle way of saying I'm creative and I'm wealthy. And by the way, this is all also clearly, this is Walt saying, listen, kid, move out the way. Daddy's back.
Daddy's
I think he's
back.
A little bit jealous of your attention.
No, he didn't. No, he's
joking.
Right. He covered them. I know. But he covered them a lot. But go ahead. Sorry.
He's caused a bit of a stir on the internet.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Well, here's Walt.
Yeah.
And five different people sent me Walt's tweet storm. I think Walt has a point. If I were the DOJ, and I don't know the chess moves here, I would have stayed focused. I think the case they have against the App Store is really rock solid. Their investment in going vertical here, I think, gives them the right to to inhibit or diminish or whatever the term is. If you have Gmail from Google, if you have the Gmail app, it's better. So is that anti-competitive? So I think they're focusing on the wrong thing here.
I agree. I think they overdid it. I think the app store is a slam dunk, and that they went overboard on the other things. And, you know, I think Apple has a very good argument that, you know, we're just a good product that people like. I think the app store, that 30%, the inability to do payments, these are things that they've won and lost on in it's not fully clear what's happening here, but that's the fight to fight. Now, I haven't talked to John Cantor or anybody else yet. Maybe I will. But I do think they gilded the lily here. It's a very good case. Cause the DOJ is making the case, what you were just talking about, the screen bubbles is in there. It's the beginning of a legal fight that could go on for years. And I think they're going to have a hard time with a lot of the things that they, I think they're going to lose on a lot of the things. And I think the app store, just drilling down on the app store seems to be like, cause they had all those amicus briefs. And I do agree that you don't have a choice. That said, you don't have a choice in Google either. So they kind of go hand in glove. There's only two systems. So what can you do to make, since this is the situation we have with phones, it's oligopoly essentially. What is the way we make it better for everyone to be able to be surfaced? I think looking at their competition with Spotify, just like in Europe, I think that's a way to look very strongly at it. When they create products, it's a very much like when Microsoft did MSN and was going after AOL. I think that's has a much more of an opening. So it's just a little, I think Walt really did sort of take it apart, like in terms of the stuff they were doing on, but not the app store. I think that is, as you said, is really the important part.
So. The most powerful part of the complaint was the following. It says, Apple wraps itself in a cloak of privacy, security, and consumer preferences to justify its anti-competitive conduct. Indeed, it spends billions on marketing and branding to promote the self-serving premise that only Apple can safeguard consumers' privacy and security interests. Apple selectively compromises privacy and security interests when doing so as in Apple's own financial interests, such as degrading the security of text messages, offering governments and certain companies the chance to access more private and secure versions of app stores, or accepting billions of dollars each year for choosing Google as its default search engine when more private options are available. In the end, Apple deploys privacy and security justifications as an elastic shield that can stretch or contract to serve Apple's financial and business interests. Jesus Christ. Everyone, go to law school and learn how to write like this. Anyways, but whoever wrote this, whatever, if anyone thinks the government is incompetent, someone at the DOJ, some junior lawyer wrote this.
I know who wrote it, but go ahead. Yeah, who's really talented. There's a deputy.
Good. And the three of you are going out with Justin Theroux. Anyways,
we are. And then we're going to have a cuddle puddle. But go ahead.
I knew him first.
You know, he likes me.
I knew him first.
He actually loves me desperately. Anyway, go ahead.
I couldn't believe I saw you. You are so invading the few things I have in my life. You're at Bill Maher with Justin Theroux. Literally. You're like, what are you going to start going to Premier League games with Emily Ratajkowski now? I mean, come on.
You haven't met her yet.
I know, because you sequestered her from me. We were meant to be together.
I've not sequestered her. Who else do you really like?
Who else do I really like? I'm not going to go into like who I like and don't like. I had another one of these douchebag CEOs get me on the phone this weekend of a big tech company and talk about how nice he is. Now I get it wrong. I'm like, how did I end up here again?
Was it Elon?
No, it wasn't Elon. I'll give you that. It wasn't Elon.
Anyway, you're not going to say
anyways, I'm sorry.
All right,
where
back
are we?
To Apple. It wasn't Tim Cook. Okay. All right. So look, this is a case that they have drawn, I think, probably too broadly, because people do have an affection for Apple and the uses of it. And if you're in the system, you like the system. And so that's what's, I don't think people don't feel like they have choice. And the stuff about the bubble, if you want to buy that iPhone, they don't have to make it easy for it to interoperate. They just don't. They absolutely, in that case, I find that to be kind of a ridiculous argument. But that said, the App Store is certainly, I think both the Google App Store and the Apple App Store have to go over and above to make it easier for competitors and not to charge things, because they're the only toll keeper. And they're going to have to do it whether they like it or not. So in that way, that to me seems very easy to remedy. And we'll see where it goes. But it's going to go on for years and years and years. But I think they overstep. But the privacy thing, look, you can both be use it as a marketing tool and also actually be quite committed to it. So I think they're both, right? That's why they're talking to Google about AI, because they don't collect a lot of data. So I don't know. I think they are committed to privacy, but I think they use it as both a marketing thing and a cudgel for people. So
it all bubbles up, and I like to go meta on this stuff. The thing that ails our country is that for the first time, a younger generation is not doing as well as their parents. That's never happened before. And Jonathan Haidt just wrote this amazing book called The Anxious Generation. So they're not only not doing as well, but every day they're reminded of how they're not doing as well, with constant benchmarking from algorithms that convince them that everyone's making a shit ton of money vacationing at the Almond and dating someone much hotter. And so the question is, how do we solve this? Through a lot of things, tax policy, vocational programming, but also we break these motherfuckers up. And it all rolls up to the same thing. Our country is angry. People don't believe in America. They're not mating because they don't have economic opportunity, because we are totally weaponized by big corporations and the wealthy and the incumbents. And I'm all of those things, and I see how terrible it is.
All right, Teddy Roosevelt, thank you for that lovely speech. I agree with you. I agree. Anyway, we'll see where it goes. But we'll see. I think this case is going to be a long time.
I don't think
time.
This one's going to work.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. All right, Scott, let's go on a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about Truth Social going public, and we'll speak to our friend at Pivot, CNN's Jim Sciutto.
Support for Pivot comes from Mint Mobile. It's that time of year, spring cleaning, and maybe you're thinking about dusting off your budget and cutting down on some of your expenses. Well, you can start by reducing your phone bill with Mint Mobile. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can say goodbye to an overpriced monthly plan or unexpected fees. You can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. That includes unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. And Mint Mobile has great rates, whether you're buying for one or for a family, and their family plan starts at just 2 lines. Signing up is super easy and painless, and you also don't need to get a new device. When you buy a Mint Mobile plan, you can use your own phone and keep your phone number and contacts. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/pivot. That's mintmobile.com/pivot. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/pivot. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plans only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Support for Pivot comes from Atlassian. Atlassian software, including Jira, Confluence, and Trello, help power the collaboration for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, or whether your team is around the corner or on another continent altogether, Atlassian software is built to help keep you all on the same page from start to finish. That way, every one of your teams, from engineering and IT to marketing, HR, and legal, can stay connected and moving together as one towards shared company-wide goals. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Scott, we're back. He's being called Don Corleone on social media, but Donald Trump's finances are about to get a big boost. Trump Media and Technology Group, the parent company of Truth Social, will likely become a publicly traded company this week following Digital World Acquisition Corp's approval of a merger last Friday. As we record this, Trump just got a lifeline for that judgment in a civil fraud case. The bond was reduced from $454 million to $175 million by the New York Appeals Court. Trump now has 10 days to post that bond. I don't know why he gets a break, but what do you think about this deal? The Trump Media and Technology Group has a market value of around $5 billion based on a $37 share price of Digital World Acquisition Corp. Trump owns 60%. His overall net worth will increase by about $3 billion. That said, you know, this is a meme stock, no matter how you slice it. There's also a lockup provision in the merger agreement that would, in theory, prevent Trump from selling his shares for at least 6 months. He can, the lockup agreement could be waived by the board, which includes his son, Don Jr., Devin Nunes, as CEO, and Linda McMahon, who used to run WWE or whatever she did over there. They're all friends of. So if he sells, you know, the price will go down. If he sells, there's going to be lawsuits aplenty. I'll say the last thing, two last things. DWAC, the SPAC that merged with Trump's company, was already a meme stock to start with. As Fast Company put it, Donald Trump's True Social could be the memeiest meme stock that ever memed. And once again, Republican mega donor Jeff Yass was the biggest institutional shareholder of DWAC, according to a report in the New York Times. He's also a major investor in TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, as we discussed last week. I don't know. This is feels like a lawsuit, like a securities lawsuit waiting to happen. But your thoughts, Scott, this is your area of expertise.
So say you were running for president and you needed a bond of $500 million and you knew someone who was the largest shareholder in TikTok. And you said, if I become president, I'll make sure it isn't banned or whatever it is. You could get someone by virtue of the White House. You could get them billions of dollars in shareholder value. And you met with them on a golf course and you said, oh, and by the way, there's a very small float in this SPAC that I have a large interest in. If you were just to throw, say, 10, 20, 30 million, maybe 50 million at this thing and keep the stock price elevated, that would make me very happy. Because when you look at Digital World Acquisition Company, the SPAC that's, I think, de-SPACing to take over Trump's Truth Social, the numbers I've seen were that year to date, it's done $3.5 million in revenue. The hottest AI companies' stocks in the world are trading at like 60 or 70 times revenue. But Donald Trump's Truth Social, which has 5 million active users, which is literally nothing, made $3.5 million. That's worth 600 times revenue. So
yeah, it
something,
is.
And maybe it's just a meme stock. But
does it feel like a way to give money? Like it just totally does. It's like this is going to be so investigated. I can't even.
Well, okay. Let me be clear. There's corruption all over Washington. Nancy Pelosi, it ends up, is the greatest.
I get it.
Speaker Pelosi or former Speaker Pelosi has godlike stock picking capability, as do a bunch of other members of Congress. There is corruption on both sides of the aisle here. This one really stinks. He has the right to start a company as a private citizen. He has the right to merge it with a SPAC. They have the right. He has the right to sell it after 6 months. I'm just speaking purely. I have never seen a company that feels like a better short. And this isn't financial advice because you have non-economic interest in this thing and it could go to 100 if he's elected president. But this is a company with $3.5 million in revenue that's trading for billions of dollars in value. He has the right to start it. He has the right to sell that stock. It's not going to happen in time unless maybe he can borrow against it. I don't know. The whole thing stinks.
Who's going to take? I mean, it's got to be donors that take. It's just, I want to file a lawsuit right now.
The president should be paid $10 million a year. Every senator should be paid $1 million a year, if not $2 million a year. Every representative should be paid $1 million a year for the following. All of your stocks go into a blind trust and they're held there for 5 years after you leave office. And you cannot go to work for anyone that's going to benefit for a government contract. Pay these people a shit ton of money so they don't have to paint their fence while they're in office for when they get out of office. It's just... the corruption here is just, it's just too tempting.
Yeah, I don't know if they, I think any sells, it'll drop the stock. I think it's a way of giving him money. This is what it feels like. It's like a back way to do it. The fact that you're mixing social media, Donald Trump, TikTok, and stock, meme stocks is just like literally, it's the peak 2024. It's peak 2024. This guy, as always, has found a way out. He's got to be the luckiest fuck in America. He really is. That said, I think this is just aching for litigators to come at this and investigators. And it'll be it's our next thing, whatever happens here, whatever the emails they're trading. By the way, this company is also embroiled in all kinds of legal action with its current, with the people who started it. There's all, and the DWAC guy. There's all kinds of, he's now suing. He's now anti-Trump and they are kind of anti-Trump also, the ones that love Trump. So within this, there's also more lawsuits. There was a good piece in the Washington Post about that and they've been following it. So there's lawsuits inside of lawsuits inside of lawsuits, which is sort of the brand of Donald Trump. So we'll see what happens here, but I don't think you should necessarily rely on this, but it's a damn good way to get him money, you know. And of course, it totally explains his flip flop on TikTok. Give me a break. You just have to follow the money with this guy because he's for sale and he loves money. And so he'll do whatever it takes to hold on to it. He'll do he'll sell a steak or water or a piece of shit university to do so. So it's kind of gross, grotesque in my feeling.
I don't have anything to add except I want to know what Walt thinks.
Justin's a rogue. Yeah, together. Maybe yeah. Walt, Justin, and I will have dinner together.
You know, you're so like, yeah. I just look at a guy and the next thing I know, you're sending me photos of you in a hot tub with them.
Well, you chose to live in London. We'd like to invite you, but you're not around.
I didn't choose. I'm an influencer, not a decision maker. I didn't choose to live here. Anyways.
Anyway, let's bring in our friend of Pivot. Jim Sciutto is CNN's chief national security analyst and the author of The Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War, which is really a happy title there, Jim. Welcome. but before we're going to talk about the book in a second, but we have to talk about this attack of the concert hall in Moscow late last week that killed at least 137 people. A branch of ISIS called ISIS-K claimed responsibility for the attack, and U.S. officials have confirmed that claim. The U.S. officials did warn about this, warn Russia both publicly and privately about intelligence pointing to an impending attack. There's no indication that Ukraine was involved in any way, despite Putin trying to make that link in an address this weekend. It underscored vulnerabilities in Russia and Putin himself. And at the time the U.S. warned him, he called the warning blackmail. Can you just talk about this? Because obviously Russia's a big character in your book.
For sure. Well, first of all, let's take Ukraine off the table. This is not a Ukraine-style attack. They have no incentive to carry out an attack like this. So let's set that, and that's the U.S. intelligence assessment. Ukraine had nothing to do with this. This group, ISIS, Khorasan, as it's known, or ISIS-K, as it's shortened, is a highly capable group. And we think of ISIS having disappeared as a threat, and it was greatly reduced following this U.S.-led campaign in Syria going back several years. But ISIS-K is an offshoot of it based in Central Asia, so kind of away from Syria, and they're still able to generate plots, including plots overseas. It's ISIS-K that the U.S. believes is behind this terror attack that took place in Iran a number of months ago, which interestingly, the U.S. warned Iran about that attack prior, much like it did with this attack, which shows you a couple things. One, the U.S. intel has a pretty decent handle on the activities of this group. But two, also, it shows you that even in the midst of this worsening standoff between the U.S. and Russia, China, but also these kind of middle powers that are situating themselves.
The proxies.
Well, the friends, like the sort of like middle power capos, right? In the larger kind of organization in Iran or North Korea. That even as that's happening, there is communication between those sides, right? And here you have an example of the U.S. reaching out, making a positive step, say, hey, guys, Russia, watch out for your southern flank here. You know, this is planning. Iran, watch out. These guys are planning something. And in each case, it kind of looks like Russia and Iran were like, I don't want to listen to you. And it didn't end up well for them.
So what's the implications right now? Because I want to use it to get into your book. What are the implications for Putin? Because he's had the guy he ended up killing in the airplane accident, but got pretty close to Moscow. He's got all kinds of issues. He obviously just won the election, so to speak. So where is he now? Because being safe in Russia was, as I recall when I was there, the prime directive of keeping people safe by instilling fear in them and protecting them.
This is his whole basis of legitimacy, right? Is I'm the strong man, I'm going to keep you safe from the various boogeymen, you know, terrorists certainly, but the US, NATO, the Ukrainians, you know, the Nazis in Ukraine, all this kind of stuff that he creates as his enemies. I mean, oddly enough, the real one is this terrorist group. The other ones are exaggerated to his own benefit. And I think it's also important to add this to our larger picture of Putin, because there's this impression of him as being 10 feet tall, right? That he's, and you remember this leading up to the invasion of Ukraine, you had a lot of folks, including in this country, who said, he's too smart, he's too wise to invade Ukraine. He would never do that. He's playing three-dimensional chess. Lo and behold, he made a dumb move, right? And here you have him again, making what appears to be a dumb move. He had a warning from the US, he didn't heed that warning. And we should not invest him with any more brilliance or, you know, wisdom than he actually has or has demonstrated. And so it is, as you say, you had a guy that drove halfway to Moscow in Prigozhin. You know, Putin later took him out, but it's not like everybody was standing in the way of Prigozhin when he was, you know, when he was doing that. So he's got weaknesses. He's not bulletproof.
So speaking of that, in your book, you write that the current world structure, you say, for US and its allies, this is a 1939 moment. What do you mean by that?
I do truly believe that. And I'll tell you, the idea for this book came to me while I was in Ukraine in February 2022, as the invasion was underway, as the tanks were coming across the border and the cruise missiles were falling on Ukrainian cities. It just struck me that while relations between the US and Russia and the US and China had been deteriorating for a number of years, and while we had warning signs, you know, major shots across the bow, like Russia's partial invasion of Georgia in 2008, its partial invasion of Ukraine in 2014, other steps that China has taken, for instance, in the South China Sea, that and a full-scale invasion of the largest country in Europe, an attempt to redraw the borders of Europe by force of arms, presents many of the ingredients that we saw in 1939. You know, you have an aggressive leader who views himself as an historic leader, righting the wrongs of the past by force of arms, and really is insatiable. He takes a piece, and then if the resistance isn't so great, he takes another piece, and he keeps going. And I speak Kaja Kallas, the Estonian prime minister, who I speak to a great deal in this book. She likes to quote Churchill on Putin. That quote, and I'm paraphrasing, but that an appeaser is someone who feeds the crocodile expecting that he or she will be its last meal. And I think there's wisdom in that when you look at Putin, that, particularly today when you have the accommodationalists who say, let's just give him Ukraine, man, it's not our war, it's gonna be fine. Actually, based on recent history, that's not the way he operates. He takes some and he's like, ah, I'm going to take the next piece and see what you do about it.
Jim, it's nice to meet you. I really appreciate and enjoy your work. So with respect to Ukraine, and then I have a broader question, even if it were to be a stalemate and end up in sort of a North and South Korea situation where unfortunately we had to redraw the map, but we agreed, all right, you have this, we have this. Hasn't this been an enormous victory for the West? Unified, Europe's a union for the first time. NATO's out of a brain coma. Putin looks terrible. I can't think this has been good for his economy. Isn't this a rallying point and something that, you know, that at the end of the day has burnished the brand and the power of the West?
I think it's a great point, Scott. And I think it's, you know, to what I was saying earlier, we should not imagine that they, Russia and China, are 10 feet tall or invested with this special wisdom, or that we are falling to pieces, right? To a straight up military point from, say, the US perspective, 5% of the US defense budget in supporting Ukraine without any boots on the ground, well, you know, at least acknowledged boots on the ground, but no US soldiers who've been killed in this conflict, has effectively neutered Russia's entire ground force capability. It could keep churning up, you know, sending cannon fodder to the Eastern Front, but it has brought that paper tiger down, right, in effect, for a very small investment, at least from the outside. Of course, the Ukrainians have made an enormous investment in blood and treasure and losses. But from a purely military perspective, enormous victory, but also a diplomatic one and an economic one. The thinking going in, and this was part Putin's miscalculation, but even folks here in the West was like, oh, NATO's going to break under this pressure. It didn't break. It's been unified. Yes, you have Viktor Orban.
It's expanded, right? Finland?
Yes, and it's expanded by two countries that resisted NATO membership for decades. They had said, we're going to be the ones in the middle, particularly Finland, right, who sort of said, you know, this, you know, with our history, yes, we've been invaded before, but we're going to find a way to kind of balance out. They've now added 800 miles to the frontier between NATO and Russia, which Russia has to defend. And economically, too, you know, Russia lost its entire energy market in Europe. China and India are happy to buy cheap Russian gas at a discount, but Germany just said it went cold turkey off of Russian energy. I mean, from that perspective, I think we have to step back and say, you know, we're not doing bad. You know?
So what is the biggest danger, though, out there for the U.S.? And talk about specifically about the relationship between Russia and China, which you wrote about in this book. U.S. officials told you about the, quote, nightmare scenario with Russia and China both deciding to make moves at the same time to regain territory. But talk about their relationship and because I think China probably looks down upon Russia in that regard, just as a useful idiot in that regard. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, you're not wrong. Bill Burns agrees with you. I interviewed him, the CIA director for this book, and he said that, you know, Russia has to be careful over time that it is not the junior partner in this no-limits partnership that Russia and China unveiled, notably just weeks before the Ukraine invasion, to see Xi and Putin hand in hand. It's interesting because that relationship has developed and become closer over a number of years. I wrote a book a few years ago called The Shadow War, which is talking about this conflict between the great powers taking place below the surface. And now I would argue it's very much above the surface. But at the time, that relationship was largely a relationship of convenience. You know, I'll scratch you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours here and there. But, you know, they're definitely tighter now. It's not a love match, right? Because they have their own disagreements, but they see benefit being together in terms of undermining the U.S. and the international system that they see as aligned against them to some degree. And it's pretty tight. You know, the one step that China has not taken that the U.S. was very worried about and it still is that providing direct weapons to Russia for its war in Ukraine. But it's done a lot. It's providing a lot of dual-use technology, a lot of things that the war wouldn't be allowed to continue. It wouldn't be able to sustain it without that Chinese support, as well as buying a lot of Russian, you know, oil and so on. So it's getting closer. But over time, you know, look at that. Russia needs China more than China needs Russia. And Putin probably aware of that, but he kind of needs them now. And China's looking to take advantage where it can.
So the title of your book, The Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War. First off, I do want to know how you see the next world war unfolding. And no one knows this, but what your scenario is there. And two, in the last 10 years, I mean, we're now spending a lower percentage of our GDP on the military than we have typically historically, and yet we spend more than the top 10 powers combined. AI is all encapsulated or being captured here. We're now the largest energy producer in the world, food independent. I mean, isn't the last decade, if you look at the data, GDP growth, inflation, isn't the data kind of reflect that the return of the great power singular and that great power is the U.S.?
We have a lot of advantages, no question, economic among them, military, technological advance. We're still, you guys both know this much better than me, but, you know, we develop technology enormously well across the board, although China's competitive in a lot of spaces. The weaknesses, right, are that China, first of all, Russia, while it is that, to quote John McCain, the gas station masquerading as a nation, it's got more nuclear weapons than anybody, and it's proven a willingness to disrupt to a degree we just haven't seen for decades, including invading the largest country in Europe, and including, as I talk about in one of the chapters of the book, coming very close to using a nuclear weapon in Ukraine, to breaking that seal on nuclear conflict for the first time in 80 years. So while their economy is decrepit and their population is shrinking and all the wealth for what it is concentrated in Moscow. And if you go to the hinterlands, it's a mess. They still have enormous capability to disrupt. And China, of course, has become an internationally formidable economy. Again, not 10 feet tall, and that economic growth, as you know, is flattening out, and their population's getting older, et cetera. But its nuclear arsenal has been doubling, tripling over time. It has created a blue water navy to project power around the world. You know, we may have, and we certainly do have advantages over them, but individually and together, they have enormous both capability and willingness to disrupt what we hold dear to a degree that we haven't seen.
Yeah, disrupt's the only. And speaking of disruption, looking ahead to the election, you described Donald Trump as a geopolitical wild card. I think that's a kind way of putting it. But what could you see him doing if he's reelected besides ranting on Truth Social?
Concrete moves, right? And in that chapter, I speak to the folks who served him at the most senior level in the last administration.
Who will not be there.
Who will not be there because they've said that he would be a disaster as president. John Kelly, his former chief of staff, quote unquote, in the book, it would be fundamentally a catastrophe for the country. John Bolton, former national security advisor, says in the book that Trump doesn't have a brain to contemplate national security policy around the world. So they say a few things they expect in another term. One, they say Ukraine aid ends. I think that's kind of to be expected based on what we've heard the president say, the former president. They believe he would take the U.S. out of NATO. And if congressional legislation, which we know was passed recently, that would require congressional approval to do so, he would neuter it effectively if he can't do it formally. And all a commander-in-chief would have to do to neuter NATO is say, I'm not going to defend. I'm not going to go to war for the Baltics. You know, not my problem. Too far away. Talk about it the way that he talks about Ukraine. And a similar view of U.S. defense partnerships with South Korea. Trump, you'll remember in his last administration, already talked about reducing the U.S. military presence there, joint military exercises. Same with Japan. And with Taiwan, across the board, his former advisors say, I would be very nervous if I were Taiwan, because John Bolton tells a story in the book where Trump, when he was president, would sit in the Oval, hold a Sharpie in his hand and point to the tip of the Sharpie and say, see that? That's Taiwan. Then he'd point to the Resolute desk and say, that's China, to make the point that Taiwan has no chance against China and therefore we have no business defending them. So that's a big deal, you know? It's a big deal.
So disastrous, in other words, disastrous. And Israel?
Israel, so he's, you know, it's interesting. I was in Israel in post October 7th and October, November, and my manuscript was largely done, but I started reaching out to context to see how is this war another battlefield, if they were seeing it for, you know, in the larger conflict. And they were absolutely seeing it. One sort of hard example of that was that Russia took it upon itself to send a SAM missile system to Hezbollah in the midst of it, calculating, it seemed, that, hey, if there's a northern front in this war, I want to make it more difficult for Israel, America's ally. You know, just to make it, you know, to some degree, they just like to throw fuel on the fire of the conflict, right? That kind of thing, because it occupies the U.S. It weakens a U.S. ally. And by the way, it's not just secret stuff. He invited the leaders of Hamas to Moscow, you know, repeatedly, Putin did. So, you know, these are not, they're not good actors, right?
He does like to get his filthy fingers into everything. He really does. What a thug. Scott, last question.
Jim, if there was a threat that you didn't think we were paying enough attention to, what would it be?
Is it AI or anything else like that?
Well, on the AI point, I talk, for instance, to Richard Moore, the head of MI6, on this in the book. And, you know, I think he describes it in a good way. The AI is a force multiplier, right? For every weapon system you're talking about, you talk about drone warfare, which we're seeing play out before our eyes in Ukraine. When those drones can be controlled by AI more so, than you're talking about swarms as opposed to individuals that can overwhelm, say, the defenses of a U.S. aircraft carrier, can turbocharge cyber attacks, which are already consequential and already show weaknesses in our system. So AI is certainly one of them. But I suppose what strikes me is that this is a multi-front conflict technologically in a way we've never seen before. Nuclear weapons, three nuclear armed powers, and by the way, no treaties with China that govern nuclear weapons, and fewer treaties with Russia. everybody has tremendous cyber capabilities that could impact not just our military, but our civilian technologies that we depend on every day, you know, GPS and, you know, train signals, et cetera. Space weapons, because we depend on space technology. Our military certainly does. Smart bombs aren't smart without GPS, but you and I do. We just know, you know, our communications and so on, which is deliberate, right? These space weapons can impact both the military and the civilian population. So that, as we were reporting a few weeks ago, when Russia talks about putting a nuke in space to zap our satellites, right? We take that seriously. We better take that seriously. So I suppose to answer your question, Scott, is that we've never faced a multi-front war like this before, with so many different technologies, both old school technologies, just the largest land war in Europe in 80 years, but superpower technologies like nuclear, cyber, and space weapons that would all be used together and create a whole spectrum conflict that would inflict pain, not just on our military, but you and me. So this impression that we could retreat behind the ramparts and say, Taiwan's not my problem. Ukraine's not my problem. The Baltics, yeah, they're nice, but I'm not going to go to war to defend them. We can't really think in those terms, because very quickly any conflict like this would impact you and me. I would say that's the threat that we need to be aware of.
What a happy thing to do. Do you have anything happy to say? Anything?
Well, to Scott's point, we, writ large, have done a pretty good job in the last couple of years, right? And I spend the whole last chapter of the book talking to folks involved every day in responding to this conflict for ways forward. And communications are important, red line communications, sharing information about, say, pending terror attacks, you know, this kind of thing, deconflicting. That stuff matters. Treaties matter, negotiations, but also standing up and defending what we think is important, you know, and clear red lines and defending those red lines. And just to be clear, I'm not a warmonger. I got a 15-year-old and a 13-year-old, right? They're not many years away from draft age if we go to war. So from a personal standpoint, I want to communicate as best I can what smart people are saying about avoiding conflict.
In any case, thank you, Jim Sciutto. And again, the book is The Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War. And I'm going to put a parenthesis that we all hope to avoid. Anyway, yes. Thank you so much.
Truly enjoyed it. Thank you, Karen, Scott.
Nice meeting you, Jim.
All right, Scott, one more quick break. We'll be back for Wins and Fails.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him. The sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where he earns 5% annual percentage yield. So he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Support for this podcast and the following message is brought to you by E-Trade from Morgan Stanley. Take control of your financial future with E-Trade, no matter what kind of investor you are. Our tools and resources can help you be ready for what's next. Now, when you open an account, you can get up to $1,000 with a qualifying deposit. Terms apply. Learn more at etrade.com/Vox. Investing involves risks. Morgan Stanley Smith Barney LLC, member SIPC. E-Trade is a business of Morgan Stanley.
Support for this show comes from NetSuite. As a business owner, you understand that growth can be a great thing. But when your business gets to a certain size, the cracks can start to emerge. Suddenly, the things you used to do in a day are taking a week. If this is you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. 1. Because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. Manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need to grow, all in one place. Right now, download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/Vox. That's netsuite.com/Vox to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/vox.
Okay, Scott, why don't you do your win and fail?
Well, I mean this sincerely. I thought you were fantastic on Mars, so that's my
quick
win. I thought it was a great show. And also the show was good. I thought Beto was good. I forget her name. I thought she was quite good.
Sarah Isker.
I thought she was quite good, and I thought he was on point. Anyway, I thought it was a great show, and I thought you were especially strong. My win is my colleague Jonathan Haidt. I think right now Jonathan is arguably one of the most influential scholars in the world. In his new book, The Anxious Generation, the thing I just love about it is he went after cancel culture, and now he's going after phones, and it's really actionable. He's basically saying that for reforms or new norms to build a healthier childhood in the digital age, and he has four things: no smartphones before high school, no social media before 16, phone-free schools, and more independence, free play, and responsibility in the real world. And these sound like simple things, but they're things that are actionable. They're things schools can do. I've been getting more involved in my kids' school to just say, how do we promote these four things? But we've talked a lot about this age gating. There's no reason anyone should be on social media before the age of 16. Schools, there's a big problem. And anyone with kids knows this. People without kids say, well, it's your fault. Just don't give them the phone. There's the kids are ostracized if they don't have these devices and are on those platforms because everybody's on them. So the only way to solve this problem is to get everyone universally off of them. And you do that through age gating and taking their phones away. My son going to boarding school has been, It's quite frankly, it's been awful for me. I really don't, and it's not about me, but of course I'm making it about me, but it's wonderful for him because they're too busy and they're too programmed and they have too many sports and too much studying and too much socialization to be on their phones, and they hand their phones in and he doesn't miss it. Anyways, his book is, I think it's going to have a real impact on the way we approach or think about new ways of approaching this incredible uptick in teen depression and anxiety at the hands of not only just social media, but handhelds. Apple plays a role here. The platforms play a role. Parents play a role. Schools play a role. But anyways, my win is Jonathan Haidt's new book and his very actionable strategies here. My fail is I don't think that people are taking seriously enough, or just along the lines of Jim Sciutto, I think the biggest threat to our national security is not, and I've talked about this before, is not Russia, it's not ISIS, it's not an invasion of Taiwan by China. I think our biggest threat is a series of factors that come together to create the loneliest generation of young people in history. And I think lonely people, specifically lonely young men, specifically lonely young men who serve in our military and at our soft tissue of our ports and our infrastructure, I think they're going to become especially prone and vulnerable to bad actors. And I think there's not only a moral obligation to get more involved in their lives, but I think it's a defense threat. I think these young men can be weaponized very easily with AI bots and disinformation when they don't have the guardrails of relationships, friends, family.
You've spoken of this many times. You've spoken of this.
I think it's a huge threat. There are a lot of things we can do to fix that, whether it's economic opportunity, after school programs, national service. I think if we're not going to do it for moral reasons, I think we should do it just out of what Jim was talking about as a defense threat.
All right. Well, okay. My fail, I think, is pretty clear, is Rona McDaniel. I mean, this is just this. We talked about this earlier. I just am like, come on, like, stop it. Like, there's, you could go on about cancel culture. This woman deserved to be canceled in some fashion, and I don't even blame her. She wants to make money. She got like zeroed out by Trump. She served him loyally, and of course he screwed her, which is what he does. Rona, whatever, however you pronounce it, I don't care. You should change your name back to Romney, by the way, which it was. She was the niece of Mitt Romney. You should spend more time with your uncle, who has a lot more backbone than you do, and ask for forgiveness from him. But I blame the executives at NBC for this. I'm so glad I got rid of my contract with them. Now, look, CNN's made a lot of dumb choices too in its history, but I would be embarrassed to be there, and I would have to quit, I guess. I don't know. It just is something.
Do you think they should pull our offer? Do you think they should say we screwed up?
I don't know. I don't know if they can. Like, the damage is already done. I don't think they should have her on, and I think no host should have to have her on. This woman has no credibility. She is literally changing her tune every 5 seconds, like drastically changing her tune. It's not even subtle. And then, in this case, it's at some point, like with Donald Trump, I'm like, I'm not even blaming him anymore because we know who he is, right? It's just, it's the people who support him that know better, and they're repulsive. And she is repulsive to me in that regard. Not physically, just repulsive as a character and a liar. She's a liar and she's a mendacious fuck. She wins the Mendacious Fuck Award of the Week. Mm-hmm. And then my win is all the fantastic stuff around the movies that made me cry, which you still haven't gotten me on. Hoosiers. No, I'm sorry, people. I didn't cry at Hoosiers. But speaking of which, I'm doing this thing in Washington, and I wish Scott would do it sometimes, where you pick a movie and then discuss it at this event. It's a movie night kind of thing. And I was trying to decide what to do, and they're like, oh, broadcast news, which I also love, or the net, something to do with net. But I am going to stick with the ones I want to, which is Roadhouse, and which made me cry because Patrick Swayze is a genius, or Gladiator. And now I may have to do Omen, the original Omen movie, which I love because the first Omen.
The nanny
Omen
hanging herself?
Yeah. I love the Omen. That didn't make me cry. I loved it. I love all the Omens as bad as they are, but there's a new one coming out called The First Omen, where we find out how it got to the Omen. It looks terrible, and I'm going to see it. So there you have it. Anyway, I thank you for all your things. Keep them coming. I'll try to cry at something. And before we go, I just want to flag a new piece in New York Magazine called Andrew Huberman's Mechanisms of Control, The Private and Public Seductions of the World's Biggest Pop Neuroscientist. Very popular podcast. I find it to be a smart Joe Rogan kind of thing. It looks fascinating. We can't wait to read it. If you do, let us know what you think. We'll read it this week and perhaps discuss it next week. We do want to hear from you. Send us your questions about business, tech, or whatever's on your mind. Go to nymag.com/pivot to submit a question for the show, or call 855-51-PIVOT. Okay, Scott, that's the show. We'll be back on Friday with more. Please read us out.
Today's show is produced by Lara Naiman, Zoe Marcus, and Taylor Griffin. Ernie Nertot engineered this episode. Thanks also to Drew Burrows and Emil Saverio. Nishat Kurwa is Vox Media's executive producer of audio. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening to Pivot from New York Magazine of Vox Media. You can subscribe to the magazine at nymag.com/pod. We'll be back later this week for another breakdown of all things tech and business. Kara, have a great rest of the week.
Claude 3 from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point of the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skill and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who use Anthropic to navigate this new frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude, Claude, today. Jumpstart your genius with Claude 3 by Anthropic.